Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation.
We're speaking today with Dr. Mitchell Elkis, who is a certified osteopathic physician as well as a board-certified neurologist and a certified acupuncturist. He's assistant professor at the Michigan State University College of Osteopathic Medicine, and Mitchell is going to be talking with us today about the multiple systems view of pain. Mitch, thank you very much for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
I was very interested in the reframing of the traditional view of pain to a more modern view that you gave at the American Academy of Medical Acupuncture's latest annual meeting this last month in Orlando. So maybe I could throw the ball out and start by asking you to explain to us the difference between the, let's say, traditional view of pain that you and I were taught in medical school and the more modern view of pain.
Well, certainly the traditional view of pain from a neurologic perspective, and even from a generalist's perspective, is that the problem is in the nervous system. And if there's a pain, the idea is to find out where in the nervous system the problem is coming from. Is it in a peripheral nerve? Is it in a spinal nerve? Is it in the brain itself? You know, what is the generator of the pain? And maybe it's in the peripheral tissues, but ultimately it's being transmitted through the nerve. So everything reduces to some kind of a neurologic paradigm at some level. And that, you know, is surfaceable and valuable to a certain degree, but what you wind up with is a fairly simplistic view of what pain represents. And some of the outcomes of that simplistic view are attempts to try and whittle away at the pain problem and say, well, it's like the peripheral nerve, so I'm going to block that peripheral nerve. Well, that's not quite it. I'm going to have to block the central nerve. And well, that's not quite it. I'm going to have to block the brain itself. And that has actually occurred along the history of the neurologic and neurosurgical intervention attempts at pain. But what has become clear is that, particularly with chronic pain, that there's a huge difference between what acute pain is and chronic pain. And acute pain is viewed as a symptom, and chronic pain is now widely understood to be a disease. In both situations, because of the nature of people being what they are as complex organisms whose design is to adapt and survive, they are open living systems, they are interacting with their world around them all the time. And pain itself is usually a signal in the acute stage, when you're talking about acute pain, is usually a signal of some kind of imminent threat, tissue injury, or the potential for tissue injury. The idea of limiting our understanding of the human being's response to pain in the purely neurologic domain really is inaccurate and incomplete. So the broader view of understanding how a person responds to pain starts to take into consideration that, in fact, the response to pain, be it a defensive, adaptive response, involves multiple systems. It involves the nervous system, to be sure. It involves the endocrine system with regards to a stress response and the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland and the adrenal glands and the sympathetic nervous system and the whole arousal, the fight or flight, the stress response system is engaged. The immune system is engaged with regards to an inflammatory response and inflammatory capacity. In fact, some people look at the immune system as the internal nervous system capacitor. The external threats to the body, be they predators or traumatic onslaughts, are usually perceived by the nociceptors, the pain-sensing elements of the nervous system. but the nervous system can't very well sense things like toxins and microbes, and those usually come from within. And the immune system is keenly able to sense those. So just like the nervous system can sense, interpret, respond, and learn, so can the immune system. So many people actually draw a parallel between the immune system for the internal environment and the nervous system for the external environment as ways that the body has for monitoring what's going on within and without itself and responding to the world around it. So that these three systems, the immune, neurologic, and endocrine systems, comprise a triad of responding systems that have been written about really quite elegantly by C. Richard Chapman from Utah. When I saw his work when it was first written about in the journal Pain in February 2009, I think, I was struck by the systems approach to understanding a complex problem. Anyone that's taken care of a patient with chronic pain knows that they are people. They are not just pains. I mean, they are not just a pain that needs to be blocked. They are people with a pain problem. And as such, they have their whole repertoire of systematic responses, and they are complex in their nature. The one thing that I saw when I looked at Dr. Chapman's work was that he never really included the musculoskeletal system as part of his, what he called, super system. So I used his super system as a stepping stone to create a larger super system in which this immune, neurologic, and endocrine system are nested within a musculoskeletal system. So that the musculoskeletal system is the agent of fighting or fleeing. It's the agent of freezing or running. It's the agent of seeking the elements in the peripheral world that satisfy the need of the individual, of the organism. It's the musculoskeletal system that is able to house the communication system, which is largely the connective tissue between the immune system and the nervous and the endocrine system. And it's the musculoskeletal system that provides the infrastructure through which all the nerves travel, through which all the blood vessels, arteries, veins travel, through which the lymphatics travel, and through which the immune system, both the cells and the cellular byproducts, are trafficked through this connective tissue. So to me, that was a way of looking at a complex problem with a complex type of systematic analysis. And with a systems-based approach, you have to have a capacity to understand a multiple variable situation. A multiple variable situation with individual components that can be broken down in very defined and deterministic subsets, so that you know that if you stimulate this nerve, it will elicit a response at that site. And all those singularly divided and divisible individual elements, when put together in a larger system, show properties like all complex systems do, of emergent properties. So that, in fact, there are properties that are attributed to the whole that are not simply the sum of the individual parts. And that's where the interesting aspect of this whole investigation really comes from. Because when we see a patient, when I see a patient, when you see a patient, we see a whole person, hopefully. And we're not just seeing parts, although we can take our evaluative skills and evaluate different axes of dysfunction or function within a given individual. At the end of the day, we have to reassemble those vectors of information and data gathering into a more complex image of what is going on with the person as a whole. And to do that requires complex system analysis. And even though that's typically the domain of mathematicians and physicists and engineers, I think as physicians, we do that in an unconscious way all the time. But I thought that in the talk that I gave at the American Academy of Medical Acupuncture, that I would try and bring that information into a more conscious realm.
You did.
So that we could start to talk about it that way.
I want to underline the way that you did that, in fact, which was to point out the features that complex systems have. And then as we think about what we're going to be talking about, which are the four pillars, so to speak, of the systems, the nervous system, the endocrine, the immune system, and the musculoskeletal, and just frame in terms of the characteristics that they have in common. You frame those as connectivity, which is to say that the interactions produce patterns of self-regulation, irritability, and that the system dynamically responds to disturbances and becomes more or less irritable depending on circumstances that are influenced by some of these other systems. Plasticity, in that they are capable of change and that the change can be nonlinear and saltatory, really jump from one state to another. And finally, the idea of the emergence and self-organization. And with that comes the concept also of nonlinearity and potentially the extreme dependence on initial conditions, thus generating what appears to be a fairly wide range of unpredictability in terms of the different responses of a particular person system to a similar stimulus based on all of these initial settings that are already in play. So I hope that the rest of the talk we can work through each of those systems and talk about some of the interconnections, how, for example, the nervous system interacts with the endocrine, how the nervous system interacts with the immune system, and vice versa, because that's one of the fascinating things about this way of thinking about pain, is that it's a two-way street. It's not just the nerve signaling to the brain and then that's that. It's the brain signaling to the adrenal glands and to the immune cells and all of these things affecting everything down to the receptor response at the initiation of the pain. It's beautiful, but it's hard to look at all at once. So what we're going to do is ask you to walk us through this in whatever you think is the best way to do it in a radio format.
Well, I think you've outlined the principal elements that underlie any kind of a systems analysis, which is that in order for a system to be functional, it has to be connected. The different elements need to be connected to one another so that we can look at the subsystems that exist as we've defined them. And in order for them to work in a cooperative fashion, they have to be linked in some way, whether it be through nerves or circulation or through connective tissue. There has to be an ability for them to be connected. And that this connectivity allows the two-direction type of interaction that you're describing that is always the case. This is always a equilibrium of some sort that's existing between these subsystems. Now, the things that shift them one way or the other are based upon the conditions that exist at any given moment. And so we'll talk about that a little bit. But the idea is that these systems, particularly these living systems, because, you know, systems can be non-living things as well, but they don't have the same properties. They tend to not be open systems in nature, and therefore they don't behave in quite the same way. The purposes of this type of a description allows us to understand the type of connectivity, the feedback loops that exist between the individual components that allow for positive and negative feedback, and that in particular allow for the properties of self-regulation, because that's really one of the most important elements of what a human being or any living organism is trying to do, which is take care of its own business. And when we talk about healing traditions, some of the most profound healing traditions take advantage of that notion, which is that the body has the wisdom and the tools to take care of its own business most of the time, and that trying to tap into the self-regulatory properties of an individual is the goal. And certainly in osteopathic medicine, that is one of the preeminent notions, that the body has the self-regulatory capacity, that there is a relationship between structure and function, that there is an internal medicine chest filled with the capacity to take care of the ills that come upon an individual in the course of their life. And the goal is to try and help that person be in touch with their self-regulatory and their healing wellness capacity, which is really a different view than many of the allopathic traditions, which is let's identify the disease process, let's try and counteract it, and then we'll see what happens. So it's a more patient-centered type of an orientation. But the idea of the systems approach allows us to, you know, use the same analysis for a planaria as for a human being, because they have maybe less complexity, but they have similar systems interacting capacities. The idea of irritability simply means that when an organism is disturbed, it responds. So naturally, when we're at rest, our homeostasis, our ability to maintain our internal milieu, certain vital functions is very important. We keep our blood pressure and our pulse and our heart rate and our blood pH, you know, our acidity, alkalinity, our oxygen level, body temperature. These things are all very, very narrowly controlled, and the body doesn't tolerate too much of a deviation from those homeostatic realms. And if they are exceeded in one direction or another for too long, usually the person will not survive. So the method of responding to these perturbations from within or from without is through what's called allostasis, the allostatic response, which is the body's attempt to bring itself back to its homeostatic, self-regulated comfort zone. And actually, you can evaluate the health of a system in part by how widely it ranges on its own. What's its normal range? If it's got a very narrow range of any particular variable, then that's a pretty narrowly ranged system. It's not as healthy as a system that can range more widely. So a person whose blood pressure, you know, if it gets down a little bit, they get symptomatic, or if it goes up a little bit, they get symptomatic. That person's not as healthy as a person who can tolerate a low blood pressure or a higher blood pressure if they're exercising without any untoward symptoms. And the other measure of the health and fitness of that system is how large of a perturbation can it tolerate and still be able to self-regulate. So if you were to take a big handful of salt or sugar or something that would try and purposely disrupt your homeostatic state, how big of a bolus of disruption can you or I or any individual tolerate and still get back to that self-regulating comfort zone? Person who can't tolerate an extra spoonful of sugar without going into a diabetic crisis, they're considered brittle. A person who can go out for a hot fudge sundae and still have a normal blood sugar within a few hours later, they're not as brittle. So those are both ways of looking at the robustness and the range of responsivity of an individual organism with regards to tolerating irritability from outside. The idea of plasticity is particularly important because plasticity is the ability to change based upon experience. That's the ability to learn. And like I talked about with the immune system and the nervous system, and I didn't mention it, but it applies to the endocrine and musculoskeletal system as well, they all have the ability to learn, the ability to learn from experience. So that allows us to move forward along the time arrow in a forward direction with the capacity to learn. One particular pet peeve that I have in dealing with patients is the common refrain that patients will offer that says, "Please make me like I was. If I could be like I used to be," and I quickly disabuse them of that notion that I don't have any knowledge about how to move backwards in time. I'm only aware of forward movement. This is unidirectional with regards to the living state. So the idea is, how can we move forward in a positive, health-oriented way that will help their life be better, not how can we go backwards? The idea of nonlinearity is a profound notion because this speaks to the idea of unpredictable things happening. It also speaks to the idea of extreme sensitivity on initial conditions. That says that if you know the exact circumstances of your starting point with any given situation, you can predict with certainty what the outcome will be, because the individual subset items, as we've referred to, they really have predictable and measurable and quantifiable and definable consequences. The problem is that it's not possible to know all the starting conditions for the entire system at any given moment, because you could say, well, you know, I can measure these 45 variables, but there's 1,000,045 variables, and you could take it from the macroscopic to the microscopic. At some level, you would need to know what every molecule is doing in order to know the exact specific conditions of any given system at its starting point. So that means that because in these systems that have the complex behaviors and the capacity for chaotic behaviors, that extreme sensitivity on initial conditions means that you can't always predict what's going to happen. So a person can bend over to pick up the newspaper every morning, 20 years in a row, in the same way, and one morning they bend over to pick up the newspaper and they can't straighten back up. And they come in with a bad back and they say, why? Why did it happen? I've done that every day for the last 20 years. Why did this happen today? Well, something was different. A our abilities to describe exactly what was different may be limited, but you can be sure that something was different. And that is a nonlinear property. So that person who couldn't straighten up after trying to pick up the newspaper, they went through a real nonlinear change of phase or state. They really moved from one state to another when they couldn't straighten back up. That kind of nonlinear phase transition is actually presumed to be part of what happens when a person goes from acute pain as a symptom to chronic pain as a disease, that something happens in a nonlinear fashion to change the state of the organism and its response internally that allows this disorder, this disease to develop. That's pretty significant when we try and understand how it is that some people exposed to the same kind of stressors respond in one way and other people in another way. I mean, it speaks to part of the differences between individuals, speaks to the differences between them at the level of their genetics, how their genetics are unwound and interpreted through epigenetics, how their genetics are translated and manifested through their DNA and RNA, and all the things that interfere, intervene, or intercede, or help those subsystems. But they make us try and differentiate individual susceptibilities and vulnerabilities based upon a multivariate analysis. And this is important because that's who people are. People are multiple variables, multiple systems all interacting together at the same time, not just a simple, well, this is a heart problem. I don't really need to think about how your emotions are or how your musculoskeletal system is or how you exist even beyond the limits of your own skin. What's your family dynamics? What's going on at work? What's going on in your community or your culture? What's going on in the world at large? You know, when you start taking this systems approach, you can continue the idea of a systematic analysis way beyond the limits of the individual's own shape and form. And that's valuable too, because that allows you to make a more comprehensive diagnosis. And I think that's really part of the value of this systematic analysis, besides the fact that it helps you understand how self-regulation and intersystemic conversation takes place, that also allows you to make a more complex and comprehensive evaluation of your patients. And if you're able to do that, then you're much more able to identify the critical vectors of disturbance and or dysfunction to which you can address specific types of therapeutic goals. So that speaks to the issue of the self-organizing element that the body has. One of the things that we see with complex systems is that they have, as they develop these emerging properties of the interactive nature, that they organize themselves. And this self-organization is part of what keeps us ticking without thinking about it. If your hand gets a cut, it heals up without you having to think specifically about how am I going to heal this cut. It has its own internal organization and regulatory capacity for doing this. And this is important. This is part of the idea of how self-regulatory systems work. Typically, when their person gets into a problem with a chronic illness in particular, there's some kind of failure of this regulatory capacity, either in the regulatory mechanism itself, in the interfaces between the systems, or in the component subsystems that have deficiencies or excesses of one of their resources, or some kind of interface disturbance. So you asked about the kinds of connections that exist between these subsystems with regards to pain and or stress. And certainly, it's easy to understand how the nervous system and the endocrine system are connected, because the nervous system, the peripheral nerves and the spinal cord and the brain, and actually the autonomic nervous system, they also are the bearers of the central nervous system components called the hypothalamus, which is the master gland in some people's conversation, or the pituitary, which is sitting right below the hypothalamus, which is where the endocrine system is coordinated through. So with the hypothalamic pituitary element engaged, the hypothalamus is a neurologic structure which is directly related through a small circulatory and a small neural linkage to the pituitary gland, which then spills its hormonal information into the bloodstream. So here's an example of the nervous system and the endocrine system being intimately linked. Now, the endocrine system produces the hormones that act through the bloodstream at a distance, but they feed back to the nervous system and tell it when to calm down or stop working or to slow down their activities. So these feedback loops, both positive feedback loops and negative feedback loops, are really part of the critical essence of how complex systems behave. And certainly anyone that has studied acupuncture, for example, would know that there is an external cycle called the nutritive cycle, which is very much a positive feedback loop. And then there's an internal controlling cycle that is a negative feedback loop. So there's, throughout history and throughout time, there's been an understanding that if you set things moving without some way of putting the brakes on, that you might wind up with an avalanche or something that's cascading out of control. So there are these internal regulatory dependencies on positive and negative feedback. Between the nervous system and the immune system, it's known that when the nervous system, when you, let's say, step on a tack and your peripheral nerves say, ouch, you know, they get stimulated, they send the message internally, you have a recognition of the ouchiness of it all, and you say, ouch, there's a chemical that is secreted by those peripheral pain fibers that alerts your central nervous system. But at the same time that it's being secreted centrally to alert your central nervous system, it's also being secreted right where it's being stimulated, out there in your foot, to help create more of an inflammation at that site, because it's important to the system to respond to that threat appropriately. And that response is partly through the nervous system and partly through the engagement of these inflammatory chemicals to ward off the threat. In the immediate phase, typically there is the attempt to stop bleeding. So there's hemostasis, there's vasoconstriction, constricting the blood vessels, there may be blanching of the skin. But after a while, when the bleeding is stopped and that's all taken care of, then there'll be redness and inflammation, a later phase. So there are these processes, and some of that is mediated through the nervous system. So that's called neurogenic inflammation or peripheral sensitization, and that's conducted through the nervous system, but it helps create more inflammation in the periphery. At the same time, these inflammatory chemicals, which are partly brought to life through the actions of the nervous system, are also the products and byproducts of the immune system. So there's cellular rushing to the scene with repair cells and response cells, and there's elaboration of chemicals to create an appropriate response that actually stimulate inflammation as a healing tool. So this inflammation takes place as part of the body's response to an external threat and an attempt to heal from it. And this inflammation is good as long as it's self-limited and appropriate in its amount and in its persistence. Obviously, inflammation that goes on too long, inflammation that goes on that is no longer adaptive to the organism, you know, these are part of the conundrums of autoimmune conditions, rheumatoid arthritis, some of the chronic pain conditions like complex regional pain syndrome, where somehow the inflammation or the nervous systems continue to respond way beyond the needs of the adaptive requirements of that organism and that individual. Likewise, the immune system produces a host of chemicals, and those chemicals are sometimes labeled interferons or cytokines or tumor necrosis factor or a variety of different kinds of subsets of these cytokines. Interleukins is another variety of them. The body responds to them with an inflammatory response locally to where they are secreted, but the nerves, particularly the nerves of the vagus nerve and the glossopharyngeal nerve, which are two cranial nerves that innervate the viscera largely, but also the periphery, they sense the presence of these cytokines and relay that information back to the brainstem and the hypothalamus, so that when you have these cytokines circulating around, both locally and then systemically, the brain becomes appraised of the situation and feels sick. So that the sickness response is actually part of the body's awareness of the presence of these cytokines. That's how it recognizes the presence of these cytokines, with a feeling of, well, I feel sick. So if you were to take a syringe full of interferon and give it to somebody, let's say they were taking it for MS, multiple sclerosis, they were taking it for hepatitis or for some other condition, that in fact, if you give them a bolus of this interferon, which is a cytokine, they might feel achy and sluggish and depressed and sick. And in fact, this is part of the sickness response that happens spontaneously when your body's responding in an inflammatory mode. And that message of sickness communicated back to the nervous system through these peripheral sensors in the, let's say, the vagus and the glossopharyngeal nerve. Interestingly enough, the sympathetic part of the nervous system also innervates all of the agents of the immune system, be they the solid organs like the spleen or the cells themselves, the white blood cells. They have receptors on the white blood cells to the circulating products, norepinephrine and epinephrine, for example, of the sympathetic nervous system. So the sympathetic nervous system has a direct effect on the immune system elements. Again, there's this link between the nervous and the immune system. So we've talked about the nervous and the endocrine and the nervous and the immune. And likewise, there's a link between the endocrine and the immune system, whereby the immune system has, through its cytokine presence, the ability to ameliorate or call forth or help quiet down the stress response as mediated by the endocrine system, which is through this hypothalamic, pituitary, and adrenal axis, or through the sympathetic medullary axis. So this is the way that the adrenal gland, through either the adrenal cortex, can turn out mineralocorticoids or glucocorticoids, cortisone-like products, or through the sympathetic system, the adrenal medulla can be turned on to release epinephrine, norepinephrine, neuropeptide Y into the bloodstream and thereby affect changes that affect the immune system themselves. So the immune system can affect the endocrine system can affect the immune system. And most of this communication between the immune, neurologic, and endocrine system is through the circulation and through the autonomic nervous system. But when you start to invoke the presence of the musculoskeletal system, then you're saying, well, what are the links between, let's say, the nervous system and the musculoskeletal system? Well, some of those are pretty obvious. There are proprioceptors and mechanoreceptors that travel all the way to the muscles and the ligaments and the tendons and the connective tissue that signal back to the central nervous system what's going on with every muscle, every joint, every ligament and tendon, how much stress and tension is on each of those elements and what position they're in and what direction they're moving and how fast it's happening. So there's clear links between the input system from the musculoskeletal system into the nervous system and output, so that there are obviously a lot of motor nerves, and they can be alpha motor neurons and gamma motor neurons, but they help control the movement of the body and therefore are the ultimate expression of the effector system. So there's obvious links between the nervous and the musculoskeletal system. Between the immune system and the musculoskeletal system, it's pretty well known that the fascial planes are where the majority of the immune cells live and travel by. And that's how they get from one place to another along these fascial planes. So when there's a wound at one part of your body or another, there's a rush of these cells, the immune cells, along the fascia, which is connective tissue, part of the musculoskeletal system. There's movement along the system to where the need is greatest. This not only involves the cells, but also the products that the cells produce, the chemical byproducts, these cytokines. They are secreted and they travel along these fascial planes. The immune system then can affect the fascia by causing inflammation in a particular fascial envelope. They can cause structural change, inflammation that actually affects the way the connective tissue behaves at that site. For example, one of the things that happens with inflammation is that it hurts, so that you stop moving the area. It's part of the way the body sends the message to you that, hey, if you want to get healing in that region, you may want to rest it after it's been acutely inflamed. And this message is partly through inflammation and its effects on the fascial system. Through the endocrine system and the musculoskeletal system, you can see links whereby the endocrine system, which is this hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis and the sympatho-adrenomedullary axis, as well as the alerting system of the locus coeruleus, this is the fight or flight mechanism. What is it that fights or flees? It is the person through their musculoskeletal system. It's the person that stands up and throws a punch or runs away. And this is mediated through the musculoskeletal system. And it's hormonally driven, but the agency for action is the musculoskeletal system. And this musculoskeletal system then feeds back its readiness or its state of readiness to the endocrine system so that they are constantly in connection between one another. So this notion of connectivity is really a critical element in understanding a complex system and how it might work at an interactive level. And any one of these points represent nodes, whether you're calling the endocrine, immune, neurologic, or musculoskeletal system a node, and the linkages, the connection points, any disturbance in any one of these nodes or any of the interconnecting links can cause a disturbance of the overall function of the system, and thereby can create a circumstance where symptoms might arise, or symptoms that the body can't handle on its own, that are not self-managed, that bring the patient to the doctor. This, therefore, allows us to understand a complex system in a way that we can apply this information to understanding a patient who is, in fact, a complex system.
Let's take a moment and consider acupuncture and how that works along these fascial planes and this particular signaling system and impacts on the nervous system, the endocrine system, and the immune system.
That's easy to do because acupuncture is a fairly straightforward intervention. It's a needle delivered with intention, and you can stimulate, and in many of the neuroanatomic models, the goal of treatment is to identify the hierarchy of nerves that are involved in the problem area. So what's the peripheral nerve that goes to that area? What's the spinal nerve that is in charge of that area? What's the central nervous system component that regulates that region? What's the autonomic regulation of that area? Where is it coming from? And then by using this neuroanatomic model, you can structure a treatment that stimulates with the needle the peripheral nerve or the spinal nerve or the spinal cord or the central nervous system using scalp acupuncture over the overlying cortical regions or the autonomic nervous system, the portion that is most relevant to the area that's got the problem. So this idea of stimulating peripheral nerves has been part of the understanding of what acupuncture can do. Now, how, in fact, the needles stimulate the peripheral nerves, I'll talk about in just a moment. When we talk about the connective tissue, one of the important things is that through all these systems, structure and function are viewed as co-dependent variables, that as structure changes, function changes. As function changes, structure changes. And some of the interesting work with fascia and connective tissue has been done with Dr. Langevin at the University of Vermont, who has demonstrated the properties of mechanotransduction, that if you take a needle, acupuncture needle, and put it in a point, first of all, if you put it in a point and then try and withdraw it with robotic arm, there'll be resistance to withdrawal greater if you put the needle in an acupuncture point than if you put it in a non-acupuncture point, number one. Number two, if you put it in a point and you rotate it a little bit, and then you actually do a biopsy of that region with the needle and the tissue all in one lump, you'll see that there is connective tissue wrapped around the needle, kind of like spaghetti coiled around a fork. And the idea is that the tugging on the connective tissue creates a tugging on the cells of the connective tissue origin, which are the fibroblasts. And when you tug on the fibroblasts, that creates a response. And this response is to create something that changes their behavior, either their behavior at a cellular level or even internally within the cell at the level of a genetic signal, so that you can change the signaling properties of this connective tissue. Likewise, when you tug on the connective tissue, this connective tissue is ubiquitous, and it wraps and ensheathes every element of the nervous system. So when you tug on the connective tissue, you also can tug on the neural elements. Likewise, when you tug on this connective tissue, you can tug on the vascular elements, which largely travel from one area to another along the fascial planes, which are the connective tissue dividing planes that separate one plane of muscles from another, one organ from another, one level from another within the body's architecture. I'm going to take a break for a second in the conversation and talk about another property of these complex systems. And that is they demonstrate fractal elements, which is that they show similarity over scale, that the gross structure of the nervous system or the vascular system is reminiscent of the microscopic geometry of the nervous system or the vascular system, that the same simple rules applied in multiple iterations over time create complex structures and the capacity for complex behaviors. So this is another important element in understanding the way these systems work. So for example, in the global body, there are anti-compression elements like bones. They prevent you from collapsing. There are tension-bearing elements like muscles and tendons and ligaments that help hold tension. And the body has taken this form of tension-bearing elements and load-bearing elements as a way of optimizing its strength per size. And this is something that's been demonstrated in the field of architecture through the work of Buckminster Fuller long ago. This is known as tensegrity, where there are both tension and anti-compression elements at work to have maximum strength with minimum mass and weight. In the body, it's bones, muscles, tendons, and ligaments, as I said. But in reality, that's at the macroscopic level. At the cellular level, there are, within the cell, anti-compression elements comprised of the microtubules, which are made up of tubulin, and they are anti-compression elements. And there are tension-bearing elements that are made up of actin, and they are within the cell, and they are tension-bearing elements within the cell. There are actually protrusions through the cell wall that are called integrins, and they link the extracellular matrix, which is produced by the fibroblasts. The fibroblasts make the connective tissue, which is collagen and elastin and reticulin and all the ground substance. This extracellular matrix, which is what I've just described, is connected to its cells of origin. And the integrins are protrusions through the cell walls that allow you to, let's say, put a stress on the extracellular matrix by tugging on the connective tissue or by twirling it around an acupuncture needle. This pulls on the integrin from outside the cell wall. That transmits the signal into the cellular innards and will stress either the anti-compression elements, the tubulin, or may put a stress on the tension-bearing elements, the actin. And in fact, one of the things that happens with this particular process, for example, in wound healing, the thing that draws the edges of a wound together are the natural triggering through the stress on this extracellular matrix and the triggering through the integrins, signaling mechanism to the actin inside the fibroblast to go from its normal state to what's called its smooth muscle state. And in the smooth muscle state of this actin, it has the ability to contract. So now this cellular fibroblast has now developed an internal amount of actin with greater contractile properties than it had before that pull the wound edges together. And this is something that the cell develops in response to a stress. And likewise, these elements don't just stop at the cytoplasm of the cell. They extend all the way to the nucleus of the cell so that they influence the way the genetic information is decoded, the way the proteins are made, the way the DNA is transcribed to RNA, the way the RNA is translated into proteins. These are measured effects that can be affected through this mechanotransduction system. And so part of the effectiveness of acupuncture is through this mechanotransduction system. Now, it's likely also that some of this information is transmitted along some of the cellular elements of the connective tissue system that are unique to the nervous system, the glial cells. The glial cells are typically understood to be the astrocytes and the ependymal cells and the oligodendrocytes, which, you know, provide the insulation around the neurons. So the neurons are the nerve cells, and all the supportive cells, the astrocytes, ependymal cells, oligodendrocytes, are connective tissue derivatives. And there's another group of them called the microglial cells, which are really macrophages or white blood cell derivatives that are in the central nervous system. So these connective tissue elements help propagate signals through the nervous system, not just the signals that we understand to be transmitted through nerves, because nerves typically have the ability to fire or not fire, to, you know, be excited or inhibited. And they work through this alternating current approach. But the glial cells have the ability to conduct direct current, not just alternating current, direct current. And so some of the effectiveness of acupuncture, certainly acupuncture when there's stimulation involved, be it manually or electrically or through a thermal mechanism, this creates a message that is conducted, at least in part, as we understand it, through the perineural cells, the cells that are the supportive structures of the neurons, not just the neurons themselves.
Would this include the Schwann cells that wrap around the nerves?
Well, the Schwann cells are the peripheral nervous system equivalent of the oligodendrocytes to the central nervous system. So though they are similar kinds of cellular elements, but when they are in the peripheral nervous system, in the peripheral nerves, they're called Schwann cells. When they're in the central nervous system, they're called oligodendrocytes. But they look quite the same, and they behave quite the same, and they have similar embryologic origins.
And thus, presumably, similar receptors on their surface.
That's correct.
Well, the glial cells, both in the brain and as the microglia, respond rather directly to the cytokines that are released by the immune cells in the periphery. I wonder if you could comment on some of the research showing that depression may, in fact, be mediated through inflammatory means?
Well, certainly when we talked about the cytokines as being categorized as interferons, interleukins, tumor necrosis factors, these are actually turned by pharmacologic companies into therapeutic drugs and agents. And we use interferons for a variety of different purposes. Very commonly, if you read in the literature about these side effect potentials for interferons, you'll see that depression is one of the potential side effects. And it's a very common side effect. So not only does the endogenous, your own body's production of interferons, produce a state of depression, but the exogenous, something from without that's given to you, can induce the same state in a relatively healthy person. If you give them a bolus of interferon, there's a very high likelihood that they will feel depressed. So it seems clear that certainly cytokines may be part of the mediation system for certain kinds or subsets of depression. And this has now become a very active field of exploration in terms of understanding why, for example, people with chronic diseases, be they inflammatory diseases or neurologic diseases or degenerative diseases, why depression is such a common concomitant to all of these chronic conditions. And we think that some of that may be cytokine dependent. And we know that some of the cytokines are released by the microglia within the nervous system themselves, that these microglia are actually macrophages that instead of living out in the peripheral world, are inside the blood-brain barrier and capable of producing these cytokines within the central nervous system and thereby having a more direct effect on the local and the systematic behavior of the nervous system.
So those cytokines would, for example, feed back, I guess, on the hypothalamus, but do they go to the higher centers like the amygdala and the hippocampus as well?
Well, presumably they do because there are microglial cells available in all these different locations. But also there's linkages between the hypothalamus and the amygdala and the hippocampus so that they are all not only representing local behavioral communities, but they are linked to one another, which is an important concept that there are these local effects and then there are regional effects and then there are global effects. And for example, certain chemicals will behave in one way in a peripheral situation, let's say, for example, corticotropin-releasing hormone. It turns out that corticotropin-releasing hormone, which is the hypothalamus's signal to the pituitary to release ACTH, which turns on the adrenal gland, the adrenal cortex, to release glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids, that in fact, there are two different kinds of receptors to corticotropin-releasing hormone. There's type 1 and type 2 receptors, and that the type 1 receptors are part of the original response to a threat or trauma, and they are very much catabolic. They break down tissues and they mobilize resources to fight off the threat. But at the same time that those type 1 receptors are being stimulated, there's a set of type 2 receptors that are already planning the recovery phase and that are anabolic, that are cell and tissue building. And that at the same time that the message to break down, tear down that system and fight off that inflammation in local messaging, there's central systemic messaging that's saying, but let's plan for recovery down the road. So that the same endocrine agent or neural agent, depending on its context, whether it's something that's considered local effect or in its more global effect, may have different properties depending on the context in which it's being evaluated. Helper T cells, for example. When you turn on helper T cells, well, there's one subset that are pro-inflammation, and there's another subset that are anti-inflammation. So that the type 1 helper T cells are inflammatory in nature. The type 2 are anti-inflammatory. These ideas actually help us to create a profile of a patient, for example. So if you take their ratio of helper T cells of the type 1 to the helper T cells type 2, you have a Th1-Th2 ratio. This determines how likely they are to have an inflammatory response to a threat of illness. And in fact, it turns out that in caregivers of patients with Alzheimer's disease, not just regular caregivers, but spouses, the primary caregivers of people with Alzheimer's disease, that they have a remarkable shift in their Th1-Th2 ratios to the Th2 response, where they don't mount an inflammation adequately, and they're prone to infection and other kinds of illnesses. So we've observed in caregiver syndrome, where you have to be careful in monitoring how the caregiver is doing, not just the patient themselves, but care for the caregiver, not just with the spouses of demented patients, but we as physicians are caregivers. And so we always are, I'm mildly self-serving, but I'm always interested in caring for the caregiver. And this TH1, TH2 ratio represents one kind of profile that you can use to evaluate the health and the inflammatory likelihood of an individual. You can do the ratio between mineralocorticoid receptors and glucocorticoid receptors, both of which are byproducts of the adrenal cortex that help you get a determination as to how likely this person will be to mount an acute response versus mount a recovery response. A shift in that ratio can indicate a potential problem. You can measure the ratios of corticotropin-releasing hormone receptor 1 versus corticotropin-releasing hormone type 2. And this ratio also helps you to understand which of these individuals and their ratios will give you information that says this person's going to have a problem with recovery, or this person's going to have a problem with the acute phase reaction to injury at all, but they won't be able to tolerate surgery so well, or they won't be able to get through this procedure because of their underlying constitutional nature. And so we now actually have some variables that we can measure that help us gain some greater insight in a quantitative way as to the constitutional nature of a given individual. We use this notion of constitution often when we speak of the health of a person. We talk about in acupuncture, you know, what's the constitutional nature of the person? This is the idea of the roots and the branches. The roots are the constitution where the person's coming from. The branches are the symptoms that they present with. And if you only look at the branches, the symptoms, and don't understand where they're coming from, then you will be limited in your efficacy by not understanding the true nature of the person.
I wanted to, in closing, bring to the audience an idea that just crossed my mind as you were speaking about the amygdala and the hypothalamus, the HPA axis, that that's really where mind-body medicine begins when you think in terms of conditioned fear and how one thinks about their illness, the sort of attitude and emotional response that they bring to a situation, and what a profound influence that has on their ability to recover. One of the roots of that mind-body interaction has to lie at that very intimate connection between the limbic system, which is the seat of memory and learning and response to fear, and the hypothalamus.
Without a doubt, referring to the work of MacLean, who talked about the triune theory of brain, where there's the reptilian brain, which we share in common with all vertebrates, which includes the spinal cord, the brainstem, the basal ganglia, and the cerebellum. Then there's the limbic brain, which is present only in mammals. And then there's the neocortex, the big hemispheres, which are characteristic of the primates and humans, obviously. There are actually some of the first elements of this mind-body connection, even in the reptilian brain, in the levels of the brainstem, where the vagal nerve and the glossopharyngeal nerve come together and provide internal information about the state of the organism. Is it hungry? Is it thirsty? Is it tired? Does it need rest? This information is relayed to the brainstem. And at the same time, there is activation of the seeking systems to seek out the sources in the external world to satisfy those needs. So there is the internal assessment, which in some people would actually equate with the emotional state of the individual. There is a convergence of information about the somatic state, what's going on in the musculoskeletal system, so that it can be activated through these reptilian brain centers, the basal ganglia, the cerebellum, to actually go out there in the world and catch a fly or get some water or take a nap. And then at the next level, at the limbic system, there's without a doubt a mind-body connection, because once again, the area of the insular cortex and the anterior cingulate cortex and the hippocampus itself provide areas where there's convergence between information from the internal organs, information from the somatic structures, the musculoskeletal system itself, along with connections to the cortex, the neocortex, and all the learned experiences of the past and all the memories and recollections. So there is this convergence of information that comes from the somatic state, from the visceral state, the emotional state, therefore the affective state, as well as the recollection of all past memory states that converge in this place. And some people have talked about the neocortex as the library where all sorts of vast hordes of information are stored, but it's the hippocampus that's the librarian. And the librarian is able to create in moment-to-moment episodic detail a living embodiment in your mind of what you are, a mind-body link at any given moment in time. And when you recall, for example, how you were at any given other time in your life, you're trying to tap into that neocortical source of information and bring it into a present tense in your hippocampus, where all present tense sense of episodic life occurs. And certainly in the world of the hippocampus and the amygdala, this we now understand is probably where the main problems with post-traumatic stress disorder lie. That normally there's a relevance detection capacity for the amygdala, which sits right above the hippocampus. And this determines how relevant any particular information from the outside world is. And should it be responded to with a shrug, or should you run away? And this relevance detection capacity of the amygdala is based upon input that's coming in from these sources, including the hippocampus and the neocortex. And its output is through the hypothalamus and the sympathetic nervous system and the pituitary gland, as we've alluded to. And normally there's a gatekeeper function of what's called the intercalated mass, a group of cells that help regulate the inputs and the outputs. And in post-traumatic stress disorder, it appears that this system is overwhelmed. Whether it's a single, very noxious influence that changes with a plastic force, in other words, something that's learned and forever changed because of one single giant stressful traumatic event, or whether it's the effect of multiple repeated traumatic events of a lesser scale but on a more chronic basis that create the disturbance in this part of the system and its ability to self-regulate. Again, self-regulation is the goal. Whether you're achieving it through acupuncture, through nutrition, through exercise, through working on proper sleep mechanisms and rest mechanisms, through positive visual imagery or self-attitude approaches, these are the ways that we use to help the body's self-regulatory system behave better. The idea ultimately is to get the system to take care of its own business. The story is that the surgery was a success, but the patient died. That's really not good enough. We want the patient to live, and we want the patient to prosper.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you, Dr. Mitchell Elkis, for coming on the program. We've just scratched the surface of this stunningly complex topic, but made a good start. Thank you again.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to Ask Dr. Don. I'll be back next week with more of your calls and emails. Until then, this is Dr. Don saying so long, and stay healthy.